Before I introduce my first guest, though, I do want to let my listening audience know that today we will be talking about some intense topics related to I guess I'm already going to be re-recording. All right. Before I introduce my first guest, I want to let my listening audience...
You can do this.
This is not usually me either. Before I introduce my first guest, I want to let my listening audience know that today we will be talking about some intense topics related to developmental trauma, abuse, parental illness, and parental death, just in case any of these topics may be a trigger. With that said, I'm very excited to introduce today's guest, Marguerite Catherine. Marguerite is an education consultant offering holistic educational services. Her passion is to help children and families thrive emotionally and educationally. She is trained and certified in mindfulness, teaching critical thinking through art, project crisis, emotion coaching, coaching young learners, and an ADHD coach. Please welcome Marguerite to the show. Welcome, Marguerite. I'm very excited to have you here today. I'm really excited for this conversation today as well.
Thank you for that great introduction.
Absolutely. So the first thing I have to dive into is tell me about holistic education consulting, because you hear about education consulting, but I really want to understand kind of your view of what is holistic education consulting?
So what I tell my clients is that in my world, a student's education must be holistic, because even for just people, you know, we need to take into consideration a child's emotional well-being, mm-hmm. their mental well-being, their spiritual well-being, and even just, you know, things like food, what they're eating, what they're drinking, things like that are important. So I like to think about the whole child. So I think of it in the whole way. And I also think about it in more of the, I guess, woo-woo holistic way too, that some people might see it, you know, taking into account their emotional well-being and their spiritual well-being.
I love that. I have to say you and I are very aligned in our thought process there. My background is in mental health in the education setting. And so I agree. I always have conversations with teachers when I used to be in the classroom and I would be overseeing them, is I was always relationship focused first.
Yes.
Because I always felt like as teachers, you know how to help a child learn. But if they're not available for learning, it doesn't matter all the tricks and skills that you have in place.
Absolutely. So
I love when I meet another educator who is aligned with that, because I don't know about you, but I tend to find a lot of people who don't have that thought process. And I don't blame teachers for that. I feel like a lot of times it comes down to the fact that teachers are often put under a lot of pressure of, you know, you have to have these scores or these outcomes. And so, you know, the structures that are put in place of schooling don't allow teachers to have this holistic approach. Do you find that you come across that?
I totally agree. And I also tell people it's how we're trained in college. Like, this is what we are trained to do. The only reason I have this extra training or these other beliefs is because I started reading other things during college, and I started kind of being a brat and challenging my professors. You know, there were things that they have in books like don't smile for the first 6 months of teaching or the first quarter or however long. Don't let your students know you have any kind of personality, that you're any sort of person. They're just there to learn and they need to know that coming in. And I hated that as a student. So I did not want to be the kind of teacher that was like that either.
I love that, because I remember when I first started teaching, that was the same messages that we got. It was something like, don't smile until November or something like that. And you're right. How does that create a conducive learning environment if kids don't think that you're there or invested or care about them? Mm-hmm. I have always personally found that you get a lot further with children when they feel like you're in their corner than if you're just this person in a room talking at them.
For sure. I remember even in one of my classrooms, I was an ESE teacher, and I had a student in there who was, it was a seventh grade classroom, but he was about 16 years old. He had been held back so many times that he was now in his little sister's class. They were together.
Wow.
And yeah, so he's having a rough time, obviously, you know. If he could do better, he would. Nobody wants to fail. Yeah. But he's in there. And I remember telling my coworkers about him, and they were like, oh, him, he's probably causing you so many issues, X, Y, and Z. And I was like, him? No, not in my classroom, because that's not how my classroom works. You know, I'm not fighting him. We have a good relationship.
I'm going to veer off for a second. Stories like that make me so sad. And I had that in my career as well, too. I had a student who, I won't say his name, but they would rhyme his name with the word virus. So it was name the virus.
Oh.
So it was horrible. It was absolutely heartbreaking. And I remember it was his junior year of high school when I was a special education teacher and I became his case manager. And I remember having all sorts of horrible things said to me by other teachers. Now, I had known him prior to becoming his case manager, but in very like small blips. Either I was the co-teacher in a classroom with him, or he had like come into a resource class I was teaching and asked me a question. And I remember when I finally got him on my caseload, I was really excited because the interactions I had with him, I had always thought he was great. And I wanted to have him. And I remember his former case manager telling me how awful it was going to be, how awful he is, how awful his parents were to deal with him. And I remember on the first day of school, I called home, which I call home on to everybody on the first day of school to introduce myself as the case manager. And I can remember the mother answering the phone and the first words out of her mouth after I said, hi, you know, I'm Kristen Eccleston. I'm your child's case manager. What did he do? And I was like, oh my God, this woman has never, ever received any positive phone call ever. Cause immediately it's the first day of school and she's already, what did he do?
Yep.
And it was so sad. And I can remember, I had a great relationship with this kid too. And I can remember going and advocating for him to other teachers and then not be willing to do stuff for him because it was him. And it was just heartbreaking because I don't feel like teachers understand the impact that they have on how a child feels about themselves. Mm-hmm. The impact that they have when you talk negatively about a child to other teachers who have never had the kid. And now they come in with a mindset of that kid. And it's just so heartbreaking because most of the time when kids are going through things like that, it's typically because they have had some level of trauma in their life or something. There's always a root, in my opinion, there's a root cause to every behavior. And sometimes us as adults, the kid is testing us. Are we gonna be one more adult who abandons or doesn't believe in them? And it's just so heartbreaking when you share that. And I know your student, my student, are not the only ones out there. And it's really sad that, you know, the people who are there in the classroom who, and again, it's not everybody. I know it's not everybody, but like we're supposed to be the champions of every kid. And I know not every kid is easy, but we're the champions.
Yeah. I remember having conversations with my administrator and being like, can I stay on this chapter a little bit longer? Like they're almost there. They're about to get it. Can I give this kid another test? Because, you know, that's also what I believe in, that mm-hmm. tests will be the final thing. Grades are supposed to just be information. This tells me you didn't do well. Let's review, let's remediate, and let's do it again. But yeah, obviously administration's not having that. And so we're kind of forced to abandon those kids in that way. Yeah. And if you have a relationship with them, then you get to have the conversation of, I don't like this either. Instead of, it is what it is. You should have done better. We're moving on.
Yes.
You know,
100%. So I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about your educational background. You have a bachelor's in exceptional student education. It sounds like you were very passionate about that during your studies. You questioned the kind of the status quo. So give me a little bit of information about your time studying, what your passions were, and maybe even how you led up to wanting to pursue that as your career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a varied primary education. I was born in Dubai. Then we moved here to Miami, where my mom is from. Then I went to public school here. Then I went to Saudi Arabia and went to private British school for a little bit, which I loved. It was great. And then came back to Miami, went to a different public school for a little bit of middle school, then went to Austria for American boarding school.
Wow.
In Salzburg, where they filmed The Sound of Music.
Oh, wow.
And then came back to Miami and finished high school in a gigantic public school, you know, in suburban Miami.
That's quite the array and spectrum of education there.
Yeah.
So very cool
experiences.
Yeah.
And when I went to college, I honestly wasn't sure what I was going to do. I thought maybe international relations. That sounds like it's up my alley. Mm-hmm. And then I think I was talking to somebody and my college was offering, like, I think scholarships if you got into the education program, and it was calling to me. I was like, you know what? I'm going to get into this and I want to be a change maker because I have all these experiences. I was already pretty outspoken in high school. I remember I would get a test and be like, you didn't teach us this, and turn it in blank and hope that they would disregard that grade. But yes, I went to college and they told us that studying ESE K-12 gave us a lot of jobs and freedom. And I thought an education degree would allow me to travel too. Mm-hmm. So there were some like peripheral reasons that I got into it. But once I was in there, I was like, oh no, I got to do something about this. And I want to be a change maker. And so I started looking up alternative books, you know, by like Alfie Kohn and Gatto, who is a little bit controversial, but some of his theories hold up, like having eighth graders do entrepreneurships and things like that. I like that kind of thing. Montessori teaching. And then whenever I had a chance to do something different in the classroom, since it wasn't necessarily my job yet, I did. So like that intern award was for teaching kids about habit change, because that's what I was interested in at the time. I thought about bringing it into the classroom.
Yeah.
And I had my ninth graders write down habits that they wanted to change. And like we went through this process, you know, habit that you want to change, what you want to replace it with, how we're going to get there. So they had this little 30-day project of changing their habits, and they loved it. Honestly, they did a really good job of it. And we had some fun classroom conversations, and it, I think, was meaningful to them, because really we don't get that many real life educational opportunities. Like in your life, you are going to have to change your habits at some point. We're going to have to unlearn and learn different things. And now's your chance to try it out and check it out with everybody who's doing the same thing as you, and with a trusted adult who's got your back and can help you out too. So yeah, I mean, that was kind of the long and short of it.
No, that is amazing. And I like it. It was a journey that took you to ultimately finding a passion, it sounds like, because I can hear the passion in your voice and how meaningful it is to you for the change to happen. And I'm going to ask you this because I'm very aligned with that. And I'm very adamant about change as well. And a lot of my passion towards change comes from my own personal experiences of what I experienced as an ADHD female, not knowing I was ADHD female growing up and going through school. And so I a lot of my passion comes from not wanting to see youth have to go through some of the same struggles as me. So I'm curious to learn, is that something where your passion comes? Where does that passion stem from that I can hear so obviously in your voice?
Well, thank you for saying that. And I totally agree with you and can relate to you that I just don't want kids to have to go through the same things that I did. Because, I mean, obviously in my education, it was a lot of moving around, and that in itself can be really devastating for a kid, you know, having to leave my friends every couple of years, not really knowing what my home is or what a home feels like. Yeah. It can be difficult to find safety and security in those instances. And at the same time, when I was going through high school, my mom got sick and with cancer, and it, to this day, like, she's still alive, but at that time she was given 3 to 5 years. She had a mastectomy, reconstruction. She eventually had brain tumors, and now, you know, she can't take care of herself. So she's in an ALF. But going through, and even prior to that, when I was a kid, my dad had heart problems and had a heart attack when I was 5. For which I would be blamed, because even though my mom was sick, she was also mentally ill and abusive. So I would be going to school with all of these heavy emotions throughout my schooling career, and nobody was talking about it. Like, all of these feelings I have inside, how do I deal with them? How can I just forget about everything when I'm here? forming attachments to my teachers because I didn't have like a good parental figure at home. And as beautiful as that was, you know, I wasn't making friends with the kids around me. I didn't really know how to do that. I was more just searching for safety and comfort in an adult. So a big part of what I do now is teaching kids about emotions and teaching them to accept themselves too, bringing shame to the forefront, because that also held me back when I started doing badly in school, started having trouble with math. Eventually it wasn't even about the skill set. It was just that I was too ashamed of myself to even try new things or even ask for help. And it's just, nobody talks about it. It feels like you're in the twilight zone. It's like, how are we all going through these things? I'm not the only one. I knew other kids who had parents who were sick or who were going through some major things. And it was like, oh, okay, well, good luck on the test today. You know, there was nothing there to support us really. And no vocabulary, nothing. And I just don't want that for my students. I want them to have some strategies. I want to have planted a seed at this time in their lives, because most of them are, you know, a little bit like upper elementary, middle school. Mm-hmm. And I want them to know that there is an alternate path. There is somebody out there who cares about them, and that these ideas are going to come up again later when they're searching for answers and strategies.
Oh man. Well, first off, let me say my heart just goes out to you for everything that you had to go through. I can imagine how incredibly difficult all of that was, as a young adult trying to navigate those emotions, those feelings, school. I mean, just intense. And I'm sad that you had to go through that, but I'm grateful that you now understand the level of need that there is in today's students, and you're using those experiences for a positive purpose. And what I want to ask you is, do you find that a lot of students often don't want anyone to know about what's going on with them or what they're feeling or what they're going through, because there's this fear almost of being seen as different or standing out? And I'm curious too, it's kind of a two-parter question. If you feel like, if you agree that you see some of that, if that is also because we don't talk about things, we don't provide students with that skill set, and so they think they are alone when really they're not. And it's this fear of people thinking that they're weird or different or something is strange is going on with them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I deal with a lot of students with ADHD, you know, as an ADHD coach, and those are the ones who are the most like, I feel different and I don't know why, and I just can't get this done, and it's because I'm lazy, and they have all these terrible adjectives to describe themselves with. And they definitely have a fear of being seen, or have students that have anxiety or low self-confidence and they have a fear of being seen. And it's interesting. It's like they live in almost like a bubble where they think everybody else is perfect, and definitely compare themselves to the other kids at school. It even comes out when they're kind of talking about, you know, wanting to get their tests and quizzes done fast. And I'm like, you have to double check your work, that kind of thing. What's stopping you from doing that? And it's like, oh, well, I don't want the kids to look at me and see me still working on my test when everybody else is finished.
Yes.
And it's, that's like just an instance, but there's just so many of those throughout the day that they are just beating themselves up the whole day. I think I'm going off topic here, but.
No. Everything is on topic.
But yeah, they definitely feel like they are different and they have a hard time being seen. And because they don't see anybody else modeling any of those behaviors of putting themselves out there, being authentic, owning up to their mistakes.
Yeah.
They don't really know what to do when they face mistakes or if they should even talk about it. And to be honest, I mean, the school system also doesn't make that easy. We're not giving them an opportunity to fix their mistakes. So why should they even bother bringing them up?
Yeah. I have read a study somewhere that students who are neurodiverse typically get upwards of 3,000 negative messages a day. And I think sometimes, I know it's horrible. And I think sometimes we don't realize they're negative messages, because I think adults come from a place of thinking that they're being motivating. That, you know, the one I like to use as the example the most is adults will say, "You're so smart. If you just tried a little bit harder, you would do this." And I think that the adult saying it doesn't realize, like, yes, you're coming from a place of what you think is encouragement. Like, you're saying, "I acknowledge how smart you are. If you just, you know, you just have to put a little bit of effort in there." But what they don't realize is, especially for students who are neurodiverse, that they are trying their hardest. They just don't always have the skill set yet. And we just assume they have this skill set to do certain things, or we're not teaching them in the way that is conducive to their brain or their interest or how they like to learn. And I feel so bad for students, because you just said, all, you know, that students will describe themselves with all these negative messages. But I really think that is the type of messages that students with ADHD, or anybody who is neurodiverse, really get on a day-to-day basis, even when the adults in their life think that they are being encouraging. Do you find that that's some of what might be contributing to this fact that students then see themselves in a negative light?
Yes, for sure. I even had this conversation not that long ago in my ADHD workshops. It was like, this is something we say to kids. You have so much potential. Yeah. You can do X, Y, Z. And it's like, ADHD is classified as a disability. And, you know, people are still on the fence about that term. But I mean, it's equivalent to telling somebody in a wheelchair, like, look, you've got legs. Just get up and go walk, you know. Yeah.
And no, it really.
Somebody with ADHD, they, and anybody on any day, is trying their best. Mm-hmm. And when they've had all this negative messaging, and if they have neurodiversity, that they are just doing so much to be out there in the world. They are doing so much just to get out of bed. They are fighting so many messages just to kind of fit in with everybody else, that they are tired. They're not lazy. They have so much going on. And I was also the student that, like, my teachers would take out in the hall and they'd be like, "Marguerite, we know you're smart. We just really need you to get your homework done."
Yes.
Or I had a student the other day whose teacher I emailed, and I was like, "Hey, he's not sure if he turned these assignments in. He has ADHD. Could you check that for me?" And she got back to me and she's like, "Yes, he needs to make the choice to do his homework so that we can make sure he's learning the lesson." And in the same email, she goes, "And he got a 95 or a 97 on his test." And I was like, so
he obviously understands it.
He got it. I know, you know, we have responsibilities in the world, or in the real world, as they like to say, but he understands the material. Mm-hmm. So that's not really your best argument here, but that's a side note. I get really angry.
My love language right now, because I completely understand. And it's the same things that I get frustrated on too, because I tell teachers all the time, what's the point of homework? To understand if they have mastery of it. So if they can show you that they have mastery in 10 problems instead of 20, what's the big deal? Or if they get 97s on the test, then they obviously have mastered it. So let's get a little flexible here in our thinking. And I also feel very strongly that ADHD, you know, being neurodiverse, it's not necessarily this disorder word that we associate it with, you know, and I think we do, because the word disorder is in these words, you know, sensory processing disorder, auditory processing disorder, autism spectrum disorder, attention deficit disorder, you know, like disorder. So I think it gets this negative stigma. But when you look at our population and the statistics of our population, most of the population is neurodiverse, and diagnoses are on the rise. And I can't help but think, and this is what I truly feel, being neurodiverse or being neurotypical, neither one of them is better than the other. It's essentially being on the same playing field, and your brain just sees and interprets the world differently. It's just taking in information differently. The problem with being neurodiverse is the world is tailored to a neurotypical mind. And so it makes it seem like you have all these issues or these problems, when in reality, you don't. You're just a fish that's being asked to climb a tree, because the world has been tailored to the neurotypical mind. But it's crazy that we haven't yet woken up, especially as an education system, and realized that most of our learners are neurodiverse. And when are we going to start teaching in a way that is conducive to neurodiverse learners instead of making it seem like they have to have 504s or IEPs or something's wrong with them in the way that they learn.
I couldn't agree more. I was at a meeting yesterday and the counselor was saying something along the lines of, oh, everybody has a 504. Like, she's like, 90% of the kids at this school have a 504 because it's a performing arts school. So everybody here is creative and has a 504 or an IEP. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, it's one of those things. If the majority has it, is it still a minority population? Is it still that they're neurodiverse? Is it still that they're not fitting in? Or is it just that every kid is different and you're treating those differences as something wrong with them? She's like, oh, everybody needs close proximity to the teacher. I'm like, yeah, of course we do. Like, when has that been not the case in learning? We learn best when it's like one-on-one or small classes or whatever. So of course they're going to learn better being close to the teacher. And I don't know. I just, that riled me up too.
No, I'm with you because it is, I think that the number of students who have 504s or is pretty significant. Mm-hmm. But yet we still look at it like it's a disability or it's something that is wrong with the student. And it's so sad. And I hate saying this because our education system is definitely hurting across our country in the fact that, you know, there's been this mass teacher exodus that has occurred since the pandemic. But part of me really hopes that along with this struggle in our education system right now, change will have to happen because at some point I feel like we have to wake up and realize that the operating system we've been using for the last 200 some years is no longer valid and that we have to start changing how we approach teaching and how we look at teachers and so many things. And I'm hoping this is finally the silver lining in what's happening right now is that we will finally start to make the change that is necessary for our youth. Because my biggest concern is that these students are coming out of school with all those negative feelings that you shared and how they feel about themselves. And I know I came out of school feeling that way. And it took me almost a decade for the light bulb to go off in my mind and go, wait a second. I actually think I might be a lot smarter and a lot more capable than I thought I was. And I think it's really unfair for youth to have to spend a decade of their life finally coming to that conclusion when they were capable all along, because most of the neurodiverse students that I run into are actually incredibly intelligent, incredibly smart, like pure cancer level of smart, but we really hinder it by making them feel like something is wrong with them.
Did you see the study done that said, or I can't remember where I read it, it was like Psychology Today or something like that, that said that some traits in neurodiversity or people who are considered neurodiverse, that it is like evolutionarily beneficial. For example, people with ADHD back in caveman days, they were the ones who were on the lookout because their brains were the ones who were more alert and their brains developed to kind of be that lookout type of person, to be that on kind of person. Mm-hmm. And that's where that might've come from. And at some point it was super beneficial to the group and to the tribe to have somebody who was on the lookout and thinking quick and had a lot of energy and all the traits that we might associate with ADHD. And they said the same thing for other types of neurodiversities, that maybe at some point they were beneficial to the group. And that's why we have them today.
I'm going to have to find that study. I'm now going to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting. I'm like, this is a great spin. Everything has a purpose for us. Mm-hmm. And with my, I always tell people, I'm like, these kids with ADHD, the only reason that they feel so bad and the only reason that like we see them in a certain light is, like you said, all of these ways that they're supposed to be in the world or all the conditions that school places on them that do not align with their brains. And for me, when I was at school and not doing my homework and thinking I was lazy, the reality was I lived in the Redlands. You don't know where I am. I lived in the farm area of my city and would drive 45 minutes to school every morning and back. And we had a goat farm. We had to wake up super early, get to school. After school, we might even be at the hospital with my mom, come home, have to do goat farmy stuff. And then I would just dissociate.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't stand to sit there with my thoughts. I didn't know how to deal with my emotions. And if you're doing homework, that's a quiet moment for you. And that would be a moment that all those thoughts and feelings could flood in. Or I have to do my algebra work and I don't know what I'm doing and I'm too scared of it to even try. Don't know who to ask for help. Don't know the help is available anywhere. Too ashamed of myself to even start. So I would just spend my whatever few hours before bedtime just distracting myself. And that's what high school looked like for me.
Yeah.
And because nobody was telling me that this was a big deal, like even my parents kind of, our family is very much like the humor route when it comes to difficult things. Nobody ever sat us down and was like, hey, you know, your mom's going through something. We're not sure what it's going to look like. Here's what you can do to prepare. Let's sign you up for therapy. Let's get all these things done. That never happened. So I was just there like, okay, is this normal? What's going on? If I'm having a problem with it, that's because I'm the difficult one. I'm the weird one. Told my whole life I was sensitive. So those things come back up. I'm just being sensitive.
Yep.
How ridiculous is that? My mom is in the hospital getting a tumor taken out of her brain. And I'm sitting there going, I'm just being sensitive if this makes me sad.
Yeah.
And then I grew up thinking I'm lazy.
Yep. I'm so sorry because I completely understand that. I got the same messages. You know, you're dramatic, you're sensitive, you're nothing's wrong with you. And I think some of it probably was the time too. Mental health was not a big factor when we were younger. You know, there was still so much stigma associated with it. And so for mental health, you know, you're fine. Everything is fine. And I think oftentimes people don't realize when you tell children that maybe in the moment, you know, they know they're not fine. And I don't know that it calms anything, but whatever they have to stuff back down to act like they're fine eventually comes back out in adulthood. And if it doesn't get dealt with when they're younger, it gets dealt with in adulthood. And it usually is a lot messier in adulthood. And it just breaks my heart to hear that you went through that. And I think so many children who are neurodiverse, I think a lot of people don't realize, like, why do you put mental health with neurodiversity? And because so many people who are neurodiverse usually also are dealing with mental health to some capacity because of all those messages that you just talked about.
It's like, I've been thinking about this too. I'm like, you know, ADHD is a huge strength in a lot of areas. And it's like, you can get all the strategies, but none of them matter if nobody's even accepting of the condition or loving of the condition, or they need to deal with all of the extra stuff that goes along with having it just because of the messages they get from the rest of the world about how they need to be or this. And like, yeah, I'm I can't word it just right yet, but there's so many messages. Even yesterday I witnessed it in action and I was like, oh, right, I need to do something about this. My student had their time reduced on their computer. So their time was limited. They couldn't spend 8 hours playing Fortnite like they wanted to. They could only spend 4 hours. And yes, you know, sometimes we need to have limitations imposed on us. And it was done without his consent or without letting him know, which, yeah, he's old enough that he should be included in those decisions or told beforehand. And so he's venting and expressing how he feels about it. And dad immediately jumps into fixer mode. You know, just like my student's like, oh, you know, I'm not going to spend as much time with my friends on the computer now. Well, go spend time with them outside. You can do this or that. You can find another thing to be with them on. And I get it. But at the same time, he needs to express himself. He's not looking for a solution. They're just looking to vent.
And a little bit of validation too.
Validation. And when they don't get that and they get solutions instead, then they, again, stuff their feelings down, try to just become solution oriented instead of letting those feelings kind of come out and be validated, if that makes any sense.
No, it does, because I think it sends this message to children that your emotions are not appropriate. To have emotions is not appropriate because there should always be a solution and not feeling of emotions. And then I think oftentimes as you go into an adulthood, you start to get this sense that feelings are wrong or feelings are bad. And that's when it comes really hard for you to cope with or deal with feelings, because you've gotten these underlying messages that I shouldn't have feelings. I should just have solutions.
Exactly. You worded it so much better than I could.
No. You teed me up. That's all. You teed me up for it.
Well, then I'm going to try to remember what you said and say it as eloquently. I also want to ask you something that's been on my mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
The difference between an excuse and a reason.
A difference between an excuse and a reason. Can you give me a little more context?
So a lot of the time, an ADHDer will be told, you're just making excuses. You know, I can't do my homework because I am so tired right now. That's an excuse. Or you're just making excuses. I'm too hungry. You're just making excuses. Everything they say is an excuse. And I'm like, when does it get to be a reason? And what's the difference?
That's a really good question, because I do always worry to some degree, you know, is there this fine line between having excuses or becoming, you know, this developed learned helplessness a little bit. But I think if an ADHD student comes to you and says, it was very hard for me to concentrate because I was so tired, or, you know, my brain was just at a point where I couldn't think anymore, and so I didn't complete it, but here's my plan too. To me, that's a reason. When the child is able to essentially express that, you know, I wasn't able to do X, Y, or Z because I couldn't concentrate, or my brain was really in a place at that moment that it just didn't allow me to me, that's a reason. Because what I don't think people understand with ADHD is it's not like a physical pain, but when you get to that point of essentially burnout, because most people, when they're ADHD and they are working, there's like a hyperfixation that comes along with it. And then after that hyperfixation ends, which is literally almost being like in a state of fight or flight the entire time. And even in your brain, that is what's happening. That's why people with ADHD tend to work best under pressure or wait to the very last second to do things, is because the part of the brain that those functions typically in a neurotypical person happen in, it's not happening in an ADHD brain. It has to move to another section of the brain that essentially triggers that fight or flight that finally gets things done. And when you come out of that state, your brain is exhausted. I mean, think about it. Fight or flight was meant for survival, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're at the watering hole and a saber-toothed tiger attacks you, and your system's essentially shut down to just leave it into your vital organ systems so that you have an adrenaline rush and you can get to wherever you need to get to and survive. Well, the same thing is happening no matter what, if you're in fight or flight. And so children, adults with ADHD really are exhausted when they come out of that hyperfixation mode. Yeah, they got a lot done, but they're exhausted. And so they hit that wall. And so I think if a student is saying, you know, I got all this done, or this happened, or these are my circumstances, and I just wasn't able to get to this, but there's that kind of plan or feeling in the future, but like, I do intend to get to it. I do have it as part of my plan. I do, you know, I want to turn this in. To me, that's where that reason versus excuse is separated. If it's the reason is I couldn't because of this, but I have my intentions to do so, versus it's an excuse if it's I couldn't and I really don't have any plans to go forward in doing it. That's how at least I differentiate between the two.
I hear you. And I would think the same thing, that they have to plan so it makes sense. But what if they like can't make sense of it? You know, if they're little and they don't have the words for it, or, you know, let's say just say I couldn't concentrate. And it's like, you're just making excuses. You need to try harder.
Well, that's where I think the adult has to be aware of what it is, what ADHD is and what it looks like. And I think that's where the adult needs to help them with that and say, okay, well, tell me what happened earlier in that day. And, you know, or, and they go, I did all these things. And then you understand why they might be exhausted, or why their brain shut down, or why they weren't available for the learning at that point in time. And then you help them. That's part of, I think, especially with people who are ADHD, with that executive functioning support, you as the adult need to go, okay, I totally get it. You know, we all have moments in our life, but we still have responsibilities. Let's make a plan together so that we can get this done at a time when it's good for you. Do we need to break it up into smaller increments? That's where that stuff like chunking or breaking things down into smaller units is so big for people with ADHD. Yeah. And it really should be for everyone. Don't you think everyone would do better with do this little amount here now, do this little amount and it's do here, instead of just saying, here's all the stuff, have it to me in 2 weeks.
Figure it out.
Especially children who we just assume have these executive functioning skills to break this huge project up into pieces. That's a great way to teach everybody executive functioning. Like this part is due here. This part is due here. And to me, that's what the adult owes, especially some of the younger guys, is let me teach you how to manage, or let me teach you so that it doesn't become this overwhelming factor. We can't just assume kids have these skills, and we can't just assume that the adults at home have these skills, because maybe these are also adults with ADHD who never got this taught to them. And it's just as overwhelming for the parent as well.
Yes. There's so many parents that they're getting so mad at their kids with ADHD. You know, they come to me, he's not doing his homework, he's lying to me all the time. And then I see those same traits in the parents and I'm like, ooh, this is some major projection stuff going on right now. We're having a problem. Or, you know, the parent starts like getting behind on sending me things and they're just not giving the same grace to the students. They're not giving grace to themselves either, to be honest, but there's just so much like blindness when it comes to ADHD or how to parent a kid with ADHD or reparent themselves. Or I even like part of the holistic thing is also that I teach my kids executive functioning, whether they're neurodiverse or neurotypical, because like you said, everybody needs it. They are specific skills and they don't know how to break things down. They don't know how to chunk them. They don't know about their emotion regulation. I even had a parent tell this kid once, like my student of mine was like crying. It was a homeschool scenario and he's crying. He's having a moment. And the mother's boyfriend at the time was living with them. And he goes up to him and he goes, regulate your emotions. Like, that'll do it. you got it. He's going to regulate those emotions now. That's all he needed to hear. He didn't think of that.
Yeah. And I think so many adults fall into that category, especially if that's how they were dealt with. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, so many people, you learn how to be a parent or deal with things because that is what was modeled to you. But sometimes some light bulb has to go off that like, hey, that didn't really work for me as a kid either.
I like that. Why would I do that to this kid?
Right. But that's, all you know. And either people have that light bulb that goes off or they don't, which is sad. But, you know, Marguerite, I have to say this conversation has been amazing. And so I do want to give you the opportunity to let my listeners know, if they wanted to reach out to you, learn more about your work, where can they find you? How can they get in touch with you?
My very long named website, MargueriteCatherine.com. My first name is 10 letters, so it's a long one. MargueriteCatherine.com. My social media is Marguerite.Catherine. That's my Instagram. I have a Facebook, but it's not super active. So Instagram and my website are the best ways.
Wonderful. And I also have that scrolling along the bottom here for those watching and those listening. I will have that in the show notes so that you can definitely find Marguerite and get in touch with her. And before we go, even though I'm sad for this conversation to end, I feel like I could talk to you for hours about this. I have to ask you, though, if you could send a message to students and or young adults right now that may be struggling with school, either academically and or socially, what message would you share?
It's a little bit cliched or I don't know, but we all just need to accept ourselves before we can change. Shame isn't going to make any real change. You can't shame yourself into getting better. All you can do is love and accept yourself and go from there. That we're all different and beautiful and unique. And it's our schooling and environment that had made us think differently. So once we can accept ourselves, then we can ask for help. If we can accept ourselves that I'm struggling in math, but I'm still a good person, then we can start asking for help. So acceptance is the message.
I love that. That's a beautiful message. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show today and for sharing your knowledge, your background, your story. It's very inspirational and amazing. And I'm so fortunate and happy to know that there are other people out there who are fighting the good fight for our children.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation. It's so good to know you.
Same here. Same here. Well, thank you everyone for tuning in to the Neurodiverse Teacher Podcast. And I look forward to seeing you next week.